In music, credit isn't always given where credit is due. Artists borrow styles and sounds and make them their own. One panel at last week's South by Southwest Music Festival tackled that issue by exploring a range of British music, songs that all found their roots in a single source, Jamaican music. Boz Dreisinger traces that musical genealogy.
You could hear it on mainstream radio in 1978, courtesy of The Police.
Roxanne, you don't have to put on the red light.
And you can hear it on British airwaves today in the music of Birmingham-born MC Lady Lashur.
When they see me coming, they know that I let go. I'm on another level. I'm a freaking rebel. So turn up the bass and don't forget to raise the treble.
It's reggae's influence on British music, something lately known as bass culture.
Hello.
Producer and DJ Ross Kwame, who's worked on BBC Radio for over a decade, sums it up.
As long as there's been reggae, more or less there's been reggae in the UK, and that influence played a massive role.
As massive a role as R&B and blues played in Britain a half century ago. Michael Riley sings lead for UK reggae band Steel Pulse.
We look at the impact of it. We look at how it's changed production. We look at the story of the remix and remix culture. We look at rave culture and the relationship to sound systems. We look at current youth and what they use as a key reference when making popular music in the UK. And we'll see that the resident black community has a major contribution that has never been fully recognised.
The contribution began in the 1950s when Jamaican immigration to the UK spiked. By the early 60s, British sound systems flourished and British ska music topped the Billboard charts.
My boy, Lollipop, you made my heart go giddy up. You are as sweet as candy. You're my sugar dandy.
West Indian immigrants to America could be absorbed into existing African-American communities. But in Britain, where there was no real black community to speak of, Caribbean people found themselves isolated. Michael Riley says that reggae became a potent way of dealing with that alienation.
Disenfranchised working class youth identified through this music, which was rebellious, it was anti-state, anti-government, it was very politically charged and it was very militant. So the black youth were very motivated and socially aware at the time. And all this came through reggae because it was not present in the schools, it was not present on television, it was not present in the books, it was not present on radio.
It was a hard task to take on, to make us all believe the conflict time, rescue us from evil claws. They wanted to achieve a bench to gain respect, defend ourselves to the end.
In the 70s, reggae exploded in the UK. Bob Marley lived in London, Eric Clapton and the Rolling Stones recorded reggae songs, and a soulful British genre known as Lover's Rock was born. But when UK reggae bands like Steel Pulse and Aswad hit the scene, they struggled to be accepted by black audiences who deemed them less authentic than Jamaican-born acts. Instead, these new bands found an unlikely fan base, punks.
We didn't care what they looked like. As long as they identified with the music at the time, it meant that we had a chance to grow. We had support.
But it was a strange kind of support.
We'd be on the way to the gig, and we'd see members of our what I'd call our core audience, these are punks, walking down the road with a bunch of skinheads, kind of fascists. We'd see them later and they'd go, yeah, Mike, if you see us in that crowd, you know, don't acknowledge us. And basically what they were saying was, look, we like the music, and when we're on the street, we're on the street. So there's a level of duality within our audience.
Punks ended up taking reggae into the mainstream. The Clash famously recorded a cover of Junior Mervyn's Police and Thieves.
Police and thieves in the street.
By the 80s, though, UK reggae suddenly had a white face. Labels opted to sign bands like The Police, Culture Club, and Madness over black British bands. And just as in America, where R&B turned to rock and roll as its performers grew whiter, these blue-eyed reggae bands in the UK, says Riley, were suddenly reclassified.
One of the things that happens in the UK with what we might call independent or underground music is that the point at which it's recognized as crossing over or becoming commercial or it starts to enter the popular charts is it's rebranded. And in that rebranding, there is generally a disconnect with the source or the origins. With regards to reggae, we find that the instance it's popular in the UK and it enters the charts, it's normally called pop.
During the 90s, reggae influenced a younger generation of British artists coming out of the rave scene.
Batman, 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 Batman.
Jungle music was essentially rave music with Jamaican dancehall style vocals. The musical hybrids kept coming, all influenced to one extent or another by Jamaican style bass. UK garage, drum and bass, dubstep. Now there's a new mashup dubbed Electro Bashy. Which one on a count sit pan up? Now just bounce pan the rhythm right there. Free bump chicks, Asian white there. Why go on busy, come and go scoop fair. Me wanna know which one on a one do the bojo. Bigger top, gyal in the body, right skin tight suit. Bring out of that bounce like Cadillac. Who wine better than that? Producer Ross Kwame says the UK music scene generates innovative hybrids because it's less confined by genre than the US.
Being a smaller place, we don't have this big 52-state view of what we're doing. Artists and musicians are just doing it in their neighbourhood, and we have means and systems of getting out here, i.e. the pirate station network, of getting these new forms heard. And because we're coming from a culture where radio in the main has not been really receptive to black music or new forms of black music, we've had to find our own ways and our own means of doing things. And that's just led to the creativity being really at street level.
That creativity is bass culture in a nutshell, creating new music from old school roots. For NPR News, I'm Boz Dreisinger. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. For the past year, a small spacecraft called Messenger has been orbiting the planet Mercury. Meantime, back on Earth, astronomers are meeting in Texas to talk about Messenger. And today, as NPR's Joe Palca reports, they revealed what they've learned so far about our solar system's innermost planet, including some surprises.
Messenger's orbit takes it to within 125 miles of the planet, and from there you can get a pretty good view. But don't expect any dazzling color pictures.
Mercury is very gray, and it's pretty dark gray, even less color variations on Mercury than we see on the moon.
Maria Zuber is an astronomer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and one of the lead scientists on the Messenger mission.
So Mercury is not a very colorful planet.
But interesting.
But fascinating.
That's why Zuber has been willing to hang around for the data she knew Messenger would be providing. And she's been waiting for that data for quite a while.
The launch date was August 3rd, 2004.
Now, you may be thinking, wait a minute, Mercury isn't all that far from the Earth. Spitting distance in astronomical terms, why does it take nearly 8 years to get there? Zuber says the answer is gravity. Mercury's orbit is close to the Sun, and if you launch a rocket towards the Sun, which is massive and has a much stronger gravity field than tiny Mercury, it's going to make the spacecraft speed up and head directly for the Sun.
And in order to get into orbit around the planet, the spacecraft has to slow down enough for the planet's gravity field to capture it.
If you have a giant rocket engine, you can use that to slow you down, but Messenger didn't have one. So instead, mission managers chose a route worthy of Rube Goldberg. Messenger did a loop around Earth and two close encounters with Venus, using those gravity fields as a kind of brake, counteracting the Sun's pull. When it arrived at Mercury in 2008, it was still going too fast to go into orbit, so it flew by Mercury three times, slowing down a little more each time.
And the fourth time it came by Mercury, it was slowed down enough that when we fired the spacecraft's main engine, Mercury's gravity field was able to capture it.
Messenger has been orbiting Mercury since March 2011. As Zuber and her colleagues reported today at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in Houston, and are publishing this week in the journal Science, Mercury has some puzzling features. For example, Zuber used Messenger's instruments to study a large crater 900 miles across called Caloris.
The northern half of Caloris' floor has actually been uplifted so that it's actually higher than its rim. And of course, craters are holes in the ground, but this hole in the ground was uplifted so high that the base of the crater is above its rim.
Another surprise is how big Mercury's core is. It's big. Zuber says to get an idea, if Mercury were an orange, the core would be the size of the fruit, while the outer crust and mantle would only be as thick as the orange peel. That's a much bigger core proportionally than the Earth has. Sean Solomon of the Carnegie Institution for Science is another one of Messenger's principal scientists. He says the spacecraft's original mission was supposed to end after 1 year, but it was working so well they convinced NASA to keep it going.
Just on Sunday, we began the Messenger extended mission,
which will last another year, so astronomers expect they'll have more to say at next year's meeting. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. For the first time, the Supreme Court has ruled that defendants have a constitutional right to decent lawyering in plea bargains. And the court went further, declaring that when a lawyer acts unethically or gives clearly wrong advice, the defendant may be entitled to a second chance at accepting a plea bargain offer. The case was decided by a 5-4 margin. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg tells us more.
The court's ruling came in two cases. In one, a Missouri college student named Galen Fry was charged with a felony for a fourth offense of driving with a revoked license. The prosecutor sent Fry's lawyer a letter offering to reduce the charge to a misdemeanor if the defendant would plead guilty and agree to a 90-day sentence. The lawyer, however, never informed his client of the offer, and when it expired, an uninformed Fry pleaded guilty with no conditions and was sentenced to 3 years in prison, 10 times the plea offer. In a second case, Anthony Cooper was charged with assault with intent to murder after he shot a woman in the thigh and buttocks. Prosecutors twice offered a plea deal with a recommended prison term of 4 to 7 years. But Cooper's lawyer advised him to reject the offer because the lawyer said Michigan law did not permit an attempted murder conviction for wounds below the waist. The advice was indisputably wrong. Cooper was tried, convicted, and sentenced to 3 times as much time in jail. In both cases, the state conceded that the lawyers provided ineffective legal assistance to their clients. But the states contended that didn't matter since there's no constitutional right to a plea bargain. Today, however, the Supreme Court rejected that argument by a 5-4 vote. The reality is that, for the most part, criminal justice today is a system of pleas, said Justice Anthony Kennedy on behalf of the court majority. 95% of all convictions are the result of a plea bargain, not a trial. And the right to adequate assistance of counsel guaranteed in the Constitution cannot exclude the central role plea bargains play. For the most part, plea bargaining determines who goes to jail and for how long. It's not some adjunct of the criminal justice system. It is the criminal justice system, Kennedy said. The court then went on to fashion a remedy, telling the lower courts that, consistent with state law, the defendants should get a second chance to accept the original offer if they can show they likely would have done so originally, that the prosecutor would not have withdrawn the offer, and that the judge would have approved it. In an unusual oral dissent from the bench, Justice Antonin Scalia blasted the decision as absurd. Until today, Scalia said, plea bargaining was a somewhat embarrassing part of the criminal justice system, a necessary evil to prevent the system from grinding to a halt if most cases went to trial. The court's decision, he charged, seeks to assure more than a constitutionally guaranteed fair trial. It, quote, embraces the sporting chance theory of criminal law, in which the state functions like a conscientious casino operator, giving each player a fair chance to beat the house, that is, to serve less time than the law says he deserves. Experts across the ideological spectrum were surprised by the breadth of the court's ruling. Kent Scheidegger of the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation said that in the Michigan assault case, the prosecution is getting the worst of both worlds.
What it bargained for was avoiding trial, and the trial's already happened.
And Stanford law professor Robert Weisberg notes that it will often be difficult to put the genie back in the bottle after the fact.
It's as if we have to erase history, forget that the defendant was convicted at a fair trial, and somehow reconstruct behind some veil of ignorance the original plea bargain to see if it would have gone down. And that's not easy.
Rachel Barco, director of the NYU Center on the Administration of Criminal Law, counters that she expects the courts will devise ways to deal with these problems, just as they have dealt with other new Supreme Court rulings in the past.
This is a very practical court, and I think what this is a court that says, look, practically speaking, plea bargaining is where we need to be policing things. This is for 95%+ defendants. All those defendants have is their lawyer. And if their lawyer is deficient, then these defendants have nothing.
Professor Weisberg adds that the court has often been infuriated by egregiously bad lawyering.
The court is very worried about the quality of legal representation for poor people. It doesn't expect it to be very good representation, but it's appalled when it's horrifically bad representation. And it's sort of saying, to the world. Get real. Most of the bad lawyering occurs in cases that involve plea bargaining, because most cases involve plea bargaining.
Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
There's a movie coming out this week based on a wildly popular novel. It's about teenagers in a dystopian society fighting to the death on TV. If you think I'm talking about The Hunger Games, you're wrong. It's a movie called Battle Royale, a hit in Japan 12 years ago. This week, the DVD is released in the U.S. Here's NPR's Netta Ulibi.
Among the admittedly select group of people who like both Japanese movies and young adult fiction, it's been a burning question.
Did Suzanne Collins knock off Battle Royale to write Hunger Games?
Grady Hendrix happens to be a young adult author and an expert in Asian film. He's read the interviews where Suzanne Collins has flatly denied knowing about Battle Royale before she wrote The Hunger Games. He says the plots are eerily similar. Battle Royale is about a bunch of school kids picked by lottery,
who are in a near-future society taken to an island to be part of a game show.
Much like The Hunger Games.
Where they are fitted with explosive collars and told that they now are each going to be given a weapon ranging from paper fans to Uzis.
Also like The Hunger Games.
And they're released onto the island and they have to kill each other until there's only one left.
Sound like Hunger Games?
I like The Hunger Games fine. I couldn't help but make the comparison to Battle Royale.
Grady Hendrix thinks Battle Royale is better than The Hunger Games. Anne McKnight was afraid to see it for years due to its ultra-violent reputation. She teaches Japanese film at UCLA.
I'm not a big horror person myself, but I did finally go to see it, and I was really pleasantly surprised, because it wasn't the sort of nihilistic bloodbath that I had expected.
McKnight is a fan of Battle Royale's director. He's best known for a series of gangster movies, kind of a Japanese version of The Wire. With Battle Royale, she was surprised by its even-handed gender politics.
Girls were imagined to be just as vicious as boys, and not just in the sort of backroom gossip and catfight mode, but out-and-out violent.
The violence in Battle Royale is not gratuitous, says Grady Hendrix. Again, like The Hunger Games, he says it's intended to be a jolting parable about war. And director Kenji Fukasaku survived World War II.
When he was 15 years old, he worked in a munitions factory in Japan during the war. It was bombed a lot, and one of his jobs at the age of 15 was to take a wheelbarrow around the factory and pick up body parts after bombing raids.
That left Fukasaku with a deep abhorrence of war and a profound sense of betrayal by grown-ups. That lasted into his own adulthood, and it fueled his decision to film Battle Royale with sweet-faced teenagers wreaking mayhem on each other to a soundtrack by Verdi. In 2000, when Battle Royale was released in Japan, it was both highly controversial and a massive blockbuster, in spite of the fact that young teenagers were not allowed to see it. And that irritated the director.
So he gave a very famous statement to the press where he said, "Kids, if you've got the courage, you can sneak in, and I encourage you to do so."
Grady Hendrix appreciated how The Hunger Games book was gory and disturbing. Like Battle Royale, it's supposed to communicate war's horrors to young teenagers. Hendrix worries The Hunger Games movie will tone down the violence and make it exciting.
The line between making violence graphic and upsetting and making violence graphic and cool is a very narrow one.
Hendrix says one of the most important things Battle Royale and The Hunger Games share is the idea of teenagers trapped in a ruined society, coerced by grown-ups into doing horrible things. Even so, they both make clear there's nothing more utopian than a teenager, even in a dystopia. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Our next story is about a first-time pilot of sorts. Back in September, for her 101st birthday, Mary Hardison took to the sky for her very first paragliding trip and soared to a Guinness World Record.
I felt very serene. I looked all around and looked at the buildings, looked at the mountains.
Paragliders take off from the ground, hanging from a parachute that catches the wind like a giant kite. And with her family cheering hundreds of feet below, Hardison soaked in the view.
There were a whole flock of little grandkids and great-grandkids that had signs that says happy birthday for me while I was up in the air. And I just enjoyed looking around.
Yesterday, the great-great-grandmother from Ogden, Utah, was officially recognized as the oldest female to paraglide tandem. And we should note that Guinness World Records doesn't have a record of anyone older, male or female, who has ever paraglided, period.
But Hardison didn't even know she was setting the record. The whole thing was a lark.
I'm one of those people that do things on the spur of the moment.
She's also not one to be outdone. After her 75-year-old son took up paragliding, she says she didn't want him to do something that she couldn't do, and this isn't the first time Hardison has done something that might be considered beyond her years.
On my 90th birthday, I went to Disneyland and went on all the adult rides that were open. So I'm just not home here sitting and moaning and groaning because I'm old.
And Hardison hopes her record can help other senior citizens by motivating them to, as she puts it, get out and do things.
In fact, Mary Hardison says she would be happy to see her record broken by another centenarian thrill seeker. For now, though, it stands at 101 years old, and it's all hers.
This is NPR News.
2 years ago this Friday, President Obama put his final stamp of approval on the sweeping health care overhaul.
The bill I'm signing will set in motion reforms that generations of Americans have fought for and marched for and hungered to see.
To hear the president describe it, Americans wanted the legislation. It's a different story if you listen to his opponents. Just last night, Mitt Romney characterized the law and Mr. Obama this way.
A president who doesn't hesitate to use all the means necessary to force through Obamacare on the American public.
So what does the American public think about the health care overhaul 2 years in? Well, opinions about the law remain divided along partisan lines. NPR's Julie Rovner explores why.
When the Affordable Care Act became law, Democrats predicted that the public would grow to like it. Well, that hasn't happened, at least not yet. Today, public opinion is almost unchanged from when the law was passed. Democrats mostly like the measure. Republicans mostly hate it. Michael Cannon, an opponent of the law who works for the Libertarian Cato Institute, says he's not a bit surprised that its popularity hasn't grown.
Even if this law was written exactly as its supporters would have liked, you still can't put lipstick on this pig. The law just takes too much from too many people to be popular with the American public.
And there's one big reason why, says Tom Miller, another opponent who's with the Conservative American Enterprise Institute. It's the so-called individual mandate, the centerpiece of the law that requires most Americans to have health insurance or pay a fine starting in the year 2014.
There was something fundamentally different about trying to jam the individual mandate down the throats of the American people. And even people who had insurance were buying it. It just didn't resonate with their core gut instincts, their larger values in history.
But supporters say the reason the law hasn't won more love is a lot more complicated. One big reason, says Princeton professor and healthcare expert Paul Starr, is that so much of the law hasn't taken effect yet.
It's impossible, really, to focus people's attention on what is in it. They're only really going to become aware of the specifics of the legislation as we get close to the point where there's enrollment in health plans and where people actually see how the health insurance exchanges work and how the subsidies work.
And there's another big reason for the lack of support. A lot of people who might like the law misunderstand what it actually requires. For example, says former Clinton administration health aide Chris Jennings, polls show that most people don't realize they don't have to drop their employer-provided health insurance starting in 2014 and buy their own.
Probably 95% of the voting public either meet the individual requirement or are exempt from it. Why aren't these messages coming through better than they obviously are.
One reason may be that the Obama administration has been spending more effort trying to put the law into effect than to dispel some of the myths about it. Nancy Ann DeParle is the White House Deputy Chief of Staff and was one of the key administration architects of the health law.
I don't think that was our primary job. I really don't. I really think our primary job was making sure that the changes that are happening to our insurance system were implemented in a careful, deliberate, transparent fashion.
DeParle blames the misperceptions, particularly about the pivotal individual mandate issue, on the law's many political opponents.
It hasn't sunk in part, again, because of the sustained campaign that's been run on the other side, that's been very effective. And you'll be hearing more about it, but the fact is, for the vast majority of Americans, they'll just check a box that says, yes, I have insurance.
But the administration's lack of messaging, not to mention the political polarization around the law, has frustrated some of the law's other supporters. John Rother runs the nonpartisan National Coalition on Health Care.
What messaging? I think the problem with something that's this controversial is it's always much easier to criticize it than it is to defend it. And given that, I think the advocates for the legislation have been missing in action.
Princeton's Paul Starr says there's another reason that opponents of the measure outnumber supporters. The entire structure of the law, preserving a private insurance system with an individual insurance requirement, was originally a Republican idea. Yet Republicans have turned against it, and they're not the only ones.
Many of the people who are unfavorable are actually unfavorable from the left and are unhappy about the law because it isn't a single-payer national health insurance plan.
Which may be yet another reason why President Obama is spending a lot more time talking to his Democratic supporters about things other than health care on the campaign trail these days. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.